answer questions. I'm in Radio.
I'm in Marina Del Rey.
Let's get love in a better place. Pick up the world, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge for a fresh new start. Day Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when live and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. This is MJ Network. And boy, do we have a hot panel today. We've got Dick Belsky, Jim Nesbitt, Davin Goodwin, John Lansing, and Derek McFadden. And what more can a girl ask for? This is fantastic. And we're going to talk about something that a lot of authors, and the books that I've read in the last week, I could tell you they're having a problem with this, called voice. The main character's voice, how you create the voice, and there are different types of voices in writing, and everyone employs their own method to get the main character to speak. And I'm not going to tell you which book it was, but last week I wanted to kill off the main character of a book because he was really in the, he was so obnoxious and so self-assured. I won't tell you who it is because you're going to know who it is. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. This company doesn't say, I'm not going to read another one, but I did a great job with what I wrote. So the voice can express the narrator or author's emotions or point of view or tone without diction. Now, some people, I'm reading a book called The Carrier, which is interesting. It has no quotation marks whatsoever. The character just rambles on, which is interesting. So you can be sarcastic, humorous, negative, argumentative, persuasive, or emotional. So here comes my first question to anybody that wants to answer that. Okay, John. When you create your novels, what do you have in mind? Use the most, the narrator expressed voice through the point of view or emotional or sarcastic tone? How do you decide how you're going to express the this particular author was self-assured, nasty, and he thought he was the smartest thing on this planet, and he was obnoxious. So how do you create a character that expresses his voice and you don't want to kill him off?
Well, I'll start if no one else is, because I know Jim Nesbitt and I know David, and I'll probably won't get a word in edgewise for the rest of the show.
Who's the first one that spoke up?
And he's cutting me off already. There you go. Hey guys, listen. I feel probably more strongly about than anything in my own writing is voice, and also in things I read. To me, it is by far the most important thing. I mean, I know as a reader, if I'm sampling somebody and I'm picking up a book in a bookstore, or I'm doing the free beginning on Amazon or whatever, that's what I'm looking for. Like, what is the voice of the person? And so when I'm writing my books, it's more important than story. It's more important than anything else. And, if you look at some of the great authors that we all have loved, mystery and over the years, I mean, starting with Raymond Chandler. What is it that Raymond Chandler? It's the voice. It's Philip Marlowe's voice. Robert Parker was Spencer's voice. And I think, for someone like myself and a lot of mystery writers who write in the first person, it's even more important because that's the only voice the reader is hearing, and it better damn well be interesting. And the only disagreement I'd give with you, Fran, is like, and I know you're saying you didn't like the character. The character doesn't always have to be likable. I mean, a lot of times, they can be annoying and you can, but just sort of, the positives have to outweigh the negatives. But, I'm probably not the only person to do this, but I probably more than anything else try and get that voice right before I start to write a book.
No, he kept saying I'm the smartest person on the world. Go on, anybody.
Dick, I agree with you on that because to me, voice is essential to one of the main drivers preached at in the book of Chandler, which is character.
Right.
And, I think all of our books are, very largely character-driven, and that's particularly important when, you're getting a first-person point of view, and that's the voice, the dominant voice you're going to hear throughout. I write a little bit differently. I change up, I get the point of view from each character. So I've got to be careful not to make them sound too much alike. I got to give them distinguishing characteristics. But that voice is one of the primary ways through both, you know, quote and interaction with other characters and internal dialogue that you define your character and, you know, you show who that person is. So
and I just say, Jim, that somebody who's read some of the Ed Earl Burch books, and you know, that is the selling point. The way Ed Earl's voice is what is the greatest thing is about those books. And you know that because that's what you try and do.
Well, thank you, Dick. I'll send you a check in the mail. But it is, to me, it's just it's the essential, or one of the essentials. You know, character and action and to me, you know, right there, right up there is you know the creating a scene so real that it becomes a character unto itself. But that voice is just an essential means of defining character.
So you write in third person. When you talk about writing your different characters and different voices,
well, it's almost like it's first person for the character.
Oh, for each of the characters.
On.
Oh, I get it.
Yeah,
I
and then I go into third person when there's interaction. So
okay,
you know, so my challenge is to you know they're all kind of grim folks in West Texas and with a you know. Texas and Southern cultural influences. So how do
right.
I make them not all sound like Bubba? So
sure.
that's the challenge.
Right.
And you know, and there's you know various tricks of the trade. You make one more eloquent. You make one more bitten. You make one sarcastic and dark. And the other one's kind of superficially sweetness and light, but his internal dialogue may be dark and grim. I mean, you know, there's just various tricks of the trade you use to, you know, give them a distinguishing voice. Now, to
right.
someone who's a non-Southerner or doesn't know Texas speak, they may sound all alike, and, you know, well, that's just the choice that I've taken, and it doesn't hit somebody's ear the right way. But it rings right. true to me, and it rings true to a lot of the Texas beta readers I use, so you know I'm satisfied. I'm delivering authentic characters with authentic
right.
voice. You may not just like Texas Bubba's, you know, or Texas Bubba-ettes. So that's my approach to it. But I wholeheartedly 100% agree with Dick Belsky. He is a smart man.
So the book I write, I mean, the book I wrote was. Can I jump in? Is
Go
it okay?
yeah, jump in.
So it's Derek here. I was very mm-hmm. conscious of my internal dialogue. My so the book is a character study for me, and it's multiple point of view. So I also had to be very careful that I wasn't writing the same voice, but also conscious of the internal dialogue as well. So I agree with all of you on that.
That's a good point, Derek. I mean, that to me is the biggest challenge is they may share a culture, but they're different people, you know.
Yes.
And some folks, some of the more minor characters, although none of my characters are really minor, I'll give a more eloquent voice, maybe make them more talky, just consciously, just to provide that contrast, you know,
because that's who they are. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It has to be who they are. You can't let the strings and the nail holes show in your trade craft. But it does. You are as a maybe a sub priority. You are consciously giving them a little bit of a different voice or a markedly different voice, and you know that'll help you out with your other characters.
Well, how does language come into it? Because sometimes I get a book with a lot of bad language and I skip right over it. And sometimes in some characters they just need to say that. So characters
well,
voice
yeah,
could be
language
positive
is
or negative, or they could be really raunchy. And, you know, some of your book, I don't care, they're fine, it's great. But sometimes when they write every other word is blank, blank, and blank, and they go like, do I have to really read this? So how do you use language and the type of vocabulary that the writer, the main character uses so that people don't get offended or they don't care? Maybe they
don't
care.
Once you define
a character. The old Birch book. Sorry, I stepped over you. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
I'm surprised you struggled through an Ed Earl Birch book, Fran, because my guy's he's blue as all get out.
I've been struggling a lot.
For me, it's all about the character. If he would talk like that, then he should talk like that.
Okay.
I'm looking at my audience and saying, I'm not going to overly swear like a whole bunch over the line, but if he's going to talk like that, and if it wouldn't be authentic if he didn't talk like that, then I have to use those words.
Because the character dictates his language. I mean, once you create the character, at a certain point in the book, the characters just take over. I write a series, and so my main core of people, I established who they were at the beginning, and with each episode or each new novel, they mature, they are going through their life experience, they're having relationships, and all of those things become part of who they are in the new book. But it's less, it's the secondary characters that maybe halfway through the book absolutely define themselves, and sometimes I'll go back to the beginning, then I'll straighten a few things out so that it's consistent. But it's all character-driven, I guess, is the only thing I'm trying to say.
I think that to me, the answer to this question is there is no answer, or right or wrong answer, because
right.
I was actually on a panel not recently, not that long ago, I think it was in Killer Nashville, and it was about using curse words, and there was a very successful thriller author who writes very violent books, a lot of sex scenes, but never used curse words. He feels very strongly about it, you know. And then, you know, you'll read other books, as you say, Fran, where they're just constantly cursing. I'm more inclined to not all the way, you know, and I agree with, you know, what was just said before. My character is set in a newsroom, so, you know, it's like if something big happens, they're not likely to say, oh, gosh, darn, or something. You know, they're more like some sort of a word. But yes, there are times when I will do it because I think it's necessary.
Organic.
But I try not to, you know, I do my best to avoid it for a lot of reasons, including, you know, some of these books wind up in libraries and kids, you know, it's just, I guess it's more effective to use words like that sparingly than to just pepper the whole thing through it. Now, that can change for the book. If you're writing a really hard-boiled book and your character is cursing all the time, then it can work. So that's why I think every author has to make that decision, and it just changes from person to person.
Right.
It's a balancing act, Dick. I mean, you know, it's my guy is an ex-cop, you know, kind of a bit of a down-and-out PI in Dallas, and you know, the world he comes from is pretty gritty and violent, so he cusses naturally. But, you know, I think in order to write effective and elegant profanity, you have to be practicing the use of it. Nothing worse than an editor who always was trying to establish how tough she was. And so she'd cuss, but there'd always be a little momentary hitch just before she said the cuss word. And it, like, came off as fake and false. And then it's a crutch to just have the guy say, you know, expletive deleted all the time to where it becomes a distraction, you know. I ask, you know, some similarly fluent, profane savvy folks, is he too profane? And, just to give a gut check, and you know, so far I haven't been called out too many times on the use of that. But at the same time, you got to make them real, you know.
Yeah.
And if your guy is in that world, Dick's right. Newsrooms I grew up in, man, it was, you know, the air was blue.
And it it's also changes over the years because I go all, you know, this, I mean, I'm an old guy, and I know there's a few other old guys on here, Bob Hunter, and I don't know the age of everybody, but I remember when Jimmy Carter was president, and he, you know, there was the '80 when Ted Kennedy was going to run against him, and we had like a famous headline that was something where Jimmy Carter was quoted, "I'll kick Ted Kennedy's ass if he runs," and there was a whole controversy, and I can't remember if we did it or we hyphenated it or what, that you couldn't use "ass" in a headline. I mean, now
times have
every
changed.
Word is and you know, I mean, you can't have a political discussion, whatever what side you're on, without referring to Trump or Biden or whoever, you know, pretty much everybody there, curse words involved, and so it's just the standards have really changed over the years.
No kidding.
But again, that still doesn't mean that as an author we have to use.
It has to be organic to the characters. If it's organic, and then the dialogue's real, and people will buy whatever they're saying. They may not like it, and you may lose some readers, but if it's organic and the characters just fly off the page, you're gonna read the book, no matter what the hell they're saying. There's a rhythm to it, and, you know, it's... Once that starts happening to me, that's when writing gets fun. When you stop editing yourself and the characters are just, like, moving.
Yeah.
So my main character has cerebral palsy like I do. And if he didn't swear, he wouldn't be authentic. Most people who read handicapped if you read handicapped people in these days, what you're reading is either the character is too broken to matter, or he's the sage teaching the able-bodied to live, and I'm not either one of those. So,
yeah. No kidding.
Oh my God. Right.
Jesus.
And I do swear, and so do you, honestly. So you get it, you get it, and that's why I use it.
Yeah.
Yeah, what leaps to mind is kind of old-school comedians criticizing younger comedians for just relying on the swear words and the F-bombs instead of developing comedy. If
that
your
doesn't
story,
make anything funny. You're either funny or you're not funny. Sorry to interrupt.
Right, exactly. Exactly. But either your story rings true and it captures the reader or it doesn't.
Right. Right.
And the use of any other device, whether it's swearing, sex, violence, or whatever, is not going to save you. So, if you're working on, and I view this as integral, you know, if you're working on a character and you're working on that voice, and if the character's real and the the story's real, the voice flows out of that, then you're in the groove. Then you're where you should be. You might lose a reader or two because they don't like it, but you know you're staying true to the character and true to the story.
Right.
Actually, I could actually see the character saying it. I could actually close my eyes and know where they are, and can tell their tone of voice. But when there's too much of the other kind of scenes, I skip over those too. My mother would not want me to read that. No, sorry. I can hear her in my head saying, "Don't even think it." So, when you write a narrative first person, do you keep it simple? Does the character ever sound like you? Do you ever want to wish that you could just be the character in the book, or does it say what you mean? And there are some authors, like I said, who bore me to tears and then keep rambling on and on and on and on and on. And I go like, is this going to ever be over? The truth of the matter is, if it's a book is 400 pages, I could read it in an hour and a half. If it takes me more than 2 days to read it, you're in trouble. Seriously. And lately, there's been not too much trouble. How do you keep it, I mean, without rambling on and on and on, the character, just keep it simple? Does the character sound like yourself? Well, I can hear the voice of your characters when you're speaking, especially in what Death Towards Deterrence, you have so many characters, I hear a whole bunch of voices, even though they're God, what can I say?
Yeah, well in What Death Taught Terrence, since I wrote it, I'll start this. What I did was, so my main character has the palsy, like I was talking about, has my palsy, and so essentially is me, And then around him, I put a family of characters and gave them different voices. But do I wish I was the character? Well, I am the character, so I guess, yeah. Because if I didn't,
you
I wouldn't
be very
me,
happy
so.
Then.
Yeah, I mean, I'm all right. I mean, I'm happy that I was able to get the book out the way it's meant to be written. Is
right, that's terrific.
Yeah.
I think that Dick Belsky here again. I think in your question of is it me? So when I'm writing the book, well, certainly because I'm writing a female character, but my previous series was Gil Malloy, a reporter, and when I wrote that character, I never thought of I was writing as me. Maybe I was writing it as the kind of person I wanted to be, kind of like who says things that I wouldn't say. And so I would draw on a lot of people that I knew in the news business. But I've had people who know me who read those Gil Malloy books, and they say, wow, the cadence, the way he talks, that's you, that's you. So I think we inadvertently do it. And obviously mm-hmm. with the Claire Carlson books, I draw on a lot of female characters. I've met a lot of very feisty, tough women journalists, and I combine that into that person. Now there's clearly there's a little bit of myself. So when Claire is talking about integrity and journalism and things like that, and how newspapers matter, a lot of that part of it is is me. But I think with all the characters, somebody once talked to me. One of my favorite shows is Curb Your Enthusiasm with Larry David, and somebody once talked about the appeal of that show is that Larry David basically says all the things to people that all of us want to say, but we don't have the we would never in a million years do it, but when he does, we go, yeah, I wish I could have done that. And I think a lot of authors, and I know myself, do that with my character. My character, says things, gets in trouble in ways mm-hmm. that I would never have the courage to do, but it's fun to write about that in a book.
I agree. I agree. I don't write in first person. I write in third person. But mm-hmm. in the Jack Bertolino series, he does things that I would never do, that I would never have the balls to do. And, but there's still parts of me that inhabit that character. That inhabit the character.
Well, I like that character, which brings me to my next question.
What was that?
Jack Bertolino has a unique way of handling difficult situations. He gets really dangerous, and a way of letting readers know his thoughts. And Dick does this also, and the other characters, other authors do it too. How do you incorporate different techniques of voice, and yet you know what he's thinking? You can hear the inner voice. As he's doing something, he's telling you, this is what I'm going to do, and I get nervous every time he does that. So how do you incorporate that? His innermost thoughts, and he's like, some people, like Jim writes in italics sometimes, so I know, oh, God, I'm in trouble. This guy's going to say something I don't want to hear. How do you do that? How do you handle difficult situations? And when he was up in that plane, I got nervous, and I was hoping
to
get the
pilot didn't crash. Right, I got nervous, too, and he got nervous.
Well,
so
yeah,
you knew everybody was nervous, and so hopefully there was conflict and tension there in that plane. I don't really – I approach it from kind of a different place because I come from acting and reading thousands – I'm exaggerating a little bit – of terrible work and great work, and I developed the muscle of knowing what – emotionally works and doesn't work in a character. So if I read something, if I write something and I read it and I go, I'd like to do that, it's allows me to move forward. I go, okay, this is cool, let's keep going. And at a certain point, you just trust that Jack Bertolino is going to do the right thing, but the circumstance sets up his moves and sets up mm-hmm. what he has to say about it. So I don't give a lot of technical thought. I get on the emotional ride, and I let that take me and help the work continue until I get to the end, which is always a happy place to get to.
I know. I got heart palpitations till the end of the book, too. That just shows that I read it. Yes, I did. Well,
thank you
and
for reading it.
Yeah, well, Well, I've been getting books that I don't even know I'm getting. I mean, my chair is filled with 20 books, and they go, are you going to read them all? Because we have no one else that's going to be brave enough to read all of them. Now, Jim, your character, too, is very unique. When I got your book from Partners in Crime, I go, what am I reading? This was really good. I like this character. Character has a unique way of expressing himself and making me laugh. And, of course, he gets into trouble with too many women, but that's okay, too. So how does he add – and you use flashbacks, too, right, in order to tell what the character does. So how do you do that and keep me from not putting – I didn't put the book down. I just read it in an hour and a half. You know that. So how does this add to voice and allow the reader to get to know him, Jim? Are you there?
Oh, yeah, I'm here. I do use flashbacks and italics to show that he's you know, something going deep into something in this past. He's also somebody who gets a little haunted, has conversations with his dead partner. You know, so I'll set that off. For the reader, you know, just kind of to show that this is internal. And to me, it's, you know, one of the main ways you define character. You know, it's both internal dialogue and in the case of conversations with his dead partner, you know, and they have a particular shorthand and profane way they talk to each other. You know, it shows who this guy is and how he thinks. And, you know, I think the point about when you're in the groove and you're not giving this a lot of thought and it's just, you know, flowing, you know, I know these guys and I kind of know what they're going to say before I put it down on the page.
Right.
I don't think about it. It just, you know, it just happens.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, they're there and they're making the point. And then, yeah, you got to go back and maybe clean it up a little bit and, you know, tighten it up. But it's authentic, and I know it's in the flow already, and all I'm doing is just doing a little light polishing.
Well,
you're
going to write another one
soon,
right?
Yeah, I'm kind of stalled out right now because of work demands, but I'm in, I guess, the first third of book four, and the Dead Certain Doubt. Does that ring true to you, Belsky?
Best titles ever. Every one of they're good books, but they're the titles really. I'm going to have to steal a title from you at some point, Nesbitt. So,
well, my bank account's a little low, Dick. So I'd be glad to sell you one.
Okay.
So, but I think the more challenging portion is when you've got something you want to say. You know, either comment on life its own self or politics or music or whatever, and you got to think your way through that. What does this guy think about this, and how would he put it? I mean, right now I'm working on a passage that's going to refer back to, you know, some of the militia crazies that have popped back up in the news. And I used to write about these guys all the time back in my journalism days and hang out with them. So, you know, I don't want to burden it with too much detail. I want to make it a kind of a shorthand reference, kind of conversational, but I've got to think my way through that. How much detail to use, how much, you know, explanatory, and what's too little to really give the reader a firm grounding in the background without making it a history lesson.
My friend used to call that stamp collecting.
You
can't do too much stamp collecting because people are just going to turn off.
Yeah. You know, you want to use just enough to be authentic and make the point the character's making in his mind without, you know, loading it up with extraneous detail.
Exactly.
And I'll make a reference here, like the 1951 playlist of a Los Angeles radio station that Dick and I talked to a fellow about. You know, I'm still shaking my head about that one, Belsky. Too much.
This is the story about overdoing research, and somebody had something in the 50s, and an author who actually wanted to find out what songs were played on a certain day so they could be, you know, realistic, you know, or something to that point. And I think Jim and I's reaction is, you know, this is fiction. This isn't, you know, this isn't rock. It's fiction, you know. I mean, you don't want to have a song that came out in 1963 being played in 1951. But the other thing is, the first person narrative, and I know you started off talking about that, Fran.
Yeah.
That you know that presents. It presents some challenges, but I think in some ways, for me, it's an easy way to tell the story because my entire book is in my character Claire Carlson's head. She's telling the story, so not only is she talking to people, but in between, when I, as the author, I'm talking as her. So you know exactly what she's thinking and why. Now, where this can get, I was going to say tricky, but actually interesting is. You know, the reader doesn't have to know everything she knows. So, like Claire can be telling some background on something, but maybe she leaves something out. So she's not lying to the reader. This is a tricky thing, and this is where you get into the sort of the unreliable narrator thing, which I can be really fascinating at times. So she'll tell you most everything she knows, and then later you'll find out, oh, wait a minute, she neglected to do this, and this was the secret she held. As a first person character author, I can do a lot more with that. And if you're writing multiple characters, a third person, then you have to approach it in different ways. And I wrote a piece for Killer Nashville not long ago that this is my 14th book. They're all in the first person. That doesn't mean I haven't written third person books, and it doesn't mean I haven't written multi character books. But the only ones I've ever got published are first person. So there may be something there. I might be better writing in first person.
They would with
really
what works.
Really, writing in first person. Did anybody ever think to tape their voices, the characters, to hear how it sounds?
Oh no, that's so self-conscious. I mean, you have to love the sound of your voice, or you know.
But isn't it interesting?
That'd be crazy
to me. Other
people
here, isn't it really interesting? I find when you hear an audio, because like I've had a couple audio versions of my book, and when you hear someone else reading your lines, that's like a really cool thing, and you're like, oh my god,
right.
I wrote that, you know.
Yeah, my audiobook is coming out very, very soon. I'm so excited. I've heard the whole thing past week, and it's the most amazing thing. I mean, hearing someone else say words that have been in your head for 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
Is nuts.
That's nice. Congrats. That's a good thing.
Thank you.
It'll be interesting. Since I write from the point of view of a dead person, it'll be interesting to see how somebody sounds when they're dead coming alive. That's something I'm so sad. It's that's the truth. Somebody had said to me, why don't you get your face? I said, no, it's okay. They let them stay dead and be happy. So, Davin, you begin your novel without telling anybody, then the person's name is the neighbor. He's the killer. So how and why did you create this, and how did you create the voice? Because nobody knows who that person was. And your main character is a detective, so and we know his thoughts, but how come you created a character that's speaking to us called the neighbor?
It's so long ago, I can't remember, to be honest with you. But I think it kind of lends back to when I was growing up. My dad, all the 70s police serial books or movie, BoJack and Columbo and everything. And every one of those always start with something happening, some kind of murder or something, some abduction or heist or something. And then the main character of the series gets involved. And I guess that's kind of where it came from is just thinking, okay, something drastic is going to happen right away that's going to thrust this protagonist into the realm of what happened. And I thought real heavily, it didn't always start off that way, but I had so many critiques that said, hey, you need a better hook, you need something that propels your hero to the end of the story right away. And that's when I came back and rewrote that first draft. So I wanted him to be a very deep and very, very dark person. And then the rest of the book isn't like that. It's just the first chapter that's very, very dark, and the rest of it is really more lighthearted.
Yeah.
I contrast.
And I've had the advantage. I've also read David's book, and for anyone who hasn't, it really he does that very effectively. Because I know when you first told me about the book, you said, "Well, I start off in the third person or whatever, and then I go to whatever you were," and I'm thinking, "Oh, that doesn't sound very good," you know. But then I picked it up. It really, really worked. That first chapter where he sets the scene just gets you into the rest of the book. And, you know, you don't know anything about the character at that point, but then the character develops, you know, after that. And so, you know, again, like, because I've been able to read a couple of these books here, you know, I know when things are really can work. And that's what you're trying to do. And that gets, you know, that also gets back to the thing that it's even more than voice, I guess, is there's nothing more important than those opening couple pages, you know. It's like whether you open it with something great from your character, so that it's like a Philip Marlowe character thing that you're grabbing, or you do, you know, like with a great action scene. But nobody, if they don't know you, they're not going to keep reading to page 20 to find something interesting. They're going to read those first two pages, and you're either going to buy into the book or not. And that's how I am. You know, if I'm reading Michael Conley or somebody, okay, I give him time. But if I'm reading somebody I don't know, they gotta get me. You know, like they gotta get me in the first couple pages. And I think most readers are like that.
Yeah.
I think you should take some of the book off my chair that I don't want to read, then I'll send them to you. You can tell me why.
Can I jump in on that, Fran?
Go on.
So my character dies on page one, and if you don't, I mean, if he dies on page 30, no one's reading that far. So he has to die on page one. And then the thing is also, I work with an agent to see if books are viable as far as if they can be published and if they should be represented. And if it takes me 20 pages to get into a book, I've probably already passed on it.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you. It takes me more than the first two paragraphs, you're in trouble as a reviewer, seriously. And I don't read the cover of the book because I don't care what the cover. It's got to be a very good prologue or a very good opening paragraph, but you guys don't have the problem, which is really good.
Prologues are so often backstory that's been shoehorned in somewhere.
Yeah.
Yep. And sometimes they're good, and sometimes I could live without them. Then there's the epilogue that sometimes ruins the whole book and says, what's going to happen? And I go, like, I don't care. How are you going to write a sequel if you're going to tell me what's going to happen? I don't care. I like open-ended endings are interesting. So how do you create a sense of spoken word? I mean, how do I know what the voice of the character sounds like? I mean, sarcastic, nasty. The narrator tells a story from different points of view, but I can sort of hear Claire's voice when she gets nasty and wants to talk to her friend and sound off. I could hear the other characters in the voice. I could hear even, well, Terrence has about 20 different characters, and they're all God. They all have different voices. So how do I know when I'm listening to the character that character has this distinct voice, and yet you have minor characters? How does the minor character come into it so that I want to get to know them so you can write a series about that person too? I'm getting bad.
The
well,
minor
that's
character.
Tricky. Go ahead. Yeah.
Can I go first on this one? So the minor characters for me are the family that's around Terrence. So they all grew up with him, and they learned his sarcasm, and so they are sarcastic. But beyond that, they're their own people. And if they don't sound like their own people, you're doing something wrong. So. And they should be interesting. If there's only one character in your book that's interesting and there's eight characters in the book, no one's going to finish it. So I want to hear what happens with all the characters.
And
I want the reader
perfect.
To want that.
That's what's nice about third person, though, because you have that character development on the main players, the secondary characters, the third, you can develop all those. So the audience, if you write well, the audience is going to enjoy that process.
If you don't do that, you know, you've got your main character who may be well defined and has a great voice surrounded by stick figures. I think way too many authors blow that chance to both define the minor characters and through that help define your major players
exactly.
by having stick figures. I feel the same way about scene, too. You know, I mean, it's like use that as an opportunity. I mean, the way people move through the land and rest a living out of it is telling. I mean, and you're showing people without, you know, hey,
without,
he's had to do this to do that. Yeah, without telling.
Without exposition.
So, yeah. Yeah,
I also think
it,
that it's a lot of it has to do with, I know for myself, a lot of it has to do with coming up with these things, not because you're planning it, because you're writing it. I mean, in the best world, your characters come alive as you write them.
Exactly.
And you may not, and I've done this, you know, like, Fran, we've talked, like, so my character, Claire, has a, a friend named Janet. And Janet is like, I tried to make her the exact opposite of Claire, where Claire is kind of like haphazard and her life's all screwed up. Janet is everything. She's a lawyer. She's like on top of everything. And so there are opposites, but they sort of attract. And when, you know, when you start writing it, I mean, I might have written Janet for like one scene, just so Claire has somebody to talk to. But then I found, you know, well, I like this character, and she grows. And then you find out more about her as the book and the series go. And I think when I think when an author is doing right, I mean, if you look at something like I mean, the most people have read the all the Spencer books. I have, you know, the Robert B. Parker books. So you not only have Spencer, but you have Hawk and you have Susan, you know, his girlfriend and the best friend. And they play big things. Now, if you read the early books, they're not in those, you know, like the first two books. It's Spencer on his own. Like, at some point, he created Susan Silverman, and then he decided, well, you know, I'm going to keep going with this. It's then the character Hawk, who's like a bad guy, but who's really a good guy. And, you know, I think if you sit and plan these things, it may or may not work. You can plan them a bit, but in the end, it's, hey, is this character working? And for me, and I'm sure for every author, one of the greatest pleasures is when a character literally comes alive before you and becomes interesting to you. Because if the character's interesting to me, I like to think it'll be interesting to the reader, too.
Yeah.
Well, that's what happens when I read all of you. But before I forget, I'm going to probably get in trouble on Monday, but this should be interesting. Lee Matthew Goldberg, Charles Salzberg, and Chris Carlson, we're going to talk about police reform, what the Democrats want, what the Republicans want, what the police did that's right, what's wrong, and the rallies that they need to stop, and all this other social distancing that is not happening, and that should be interesting on Monday at 10. And, Jim, let me know if you're going to join us. This is going to have to come up with talking points.
Yeah, I should be able to join, the only if I get swept away by last-second demands at the day job, I'll let you know as soon as I know.
That's okay. And on the last show for the month of June, until August 3rd, I'm hoping he does. They're allowing me to take a break, maybe. June 30th, Pastor Michael Jones will be here. We're going to talk about how to get along, how to say some prayers, and how to say something positive to people rather than the negative. And Michael is a good friend, and he's great. And then I start back on August 3rd with Mark Sass, about a young man called Moses the Singer, and he's a man without a country, and how some teenagers saved his life, and he's calling from Saudi Arabia. And I'm really excited. I finally got him on my show. So that's what's coming up. Of course, John Land will be there in August, and Jeff Bond three times. It should be interesting. And here's another question that's coming up on my paper. How do you create a sense of, does your character ever sound cynical, overly possessive, nasty, inspirational? What would you say your character's tone of voice is? Because all of your characters are different. So if I would listen to them on a tape or audio book, what kind of a voice would I hear that would make me want to listen to audio? Because Fran doesn't listen to anything except print. Seriously.
An interesting voice.
I think my
voice.
Character's voice. Can I think my character's voice that changes from the beginning of the book when he's cynical to the end of the book when he's hopefully been changed and is inspiring. And that's just character arc. So I think voice changes with character arc.
That's interesting. Does anybody else
have
a...
You can't just sound one note throughout.
Yeah.
I mean, that's gonna eventually bore readers. You know, it has to be authentic. It has to come from a real place or a place that, you know, appears real to the reader. But, you know, you got to mix up the moods. I mean, we're human beings. You know, you can't be hard-bitten and cynical all the time.
Right.
You know, and that's why, you know, artful use of both internal and external dialogue is so important. You know, I mean, my guy, Ed Earl, he comes, you know,
when
you're listening to him talk, he's you know, he's an inveterate smartass and always says what he's thinking without much of a filter and gets him in trouble. And he's, you know, pretty hard-bitten and cynical. But if he were that way all the way through, if he wasn't, you know, flawed, if he wasn't angst-ridden, if I didn't show some of those other qualities, he would be a stick figure. So, you know, you have to be aware of that and create a fully, you know, fully formed character.
And here's
the story dictates the emotional life. Your character has to change with the conflict, with the joy in his life, with his love, whatever it is, he changes. So, you know, that's it keeps it – the complexity is what makes it wonderful and sucks people in and keeps you interested in writing that character. It's not one note.
Exactly.
If it's one note, you're in big trouble. And you know, you're not even enjoy writing – a character like that. I've had to write a few characters like that.
If it's one note, your character is going to be flat, and you probably won't even finish the book.
Yeah, there you go.
But here's another interesting balance that I'm aware of when I write, and I think we all are, which is you can be too authentic. You know, people always say to me like, "Oh, wow, you know, Claire Carlson, that's a real that's exactly what happens in a newsroom." Well, no, it isn't, because the point is, most people, when we talk to people, they have a lot of boring things to say. You know, it's how you doing? No, not much. I'm feeling okay. Nothing really happened. The weather's fine. A lot of buzz. And, you know, and in a book, you know, if you were going to really convey the way a person wrote, you would include all that. But nobody wants to read it. So everything is always exciting, and it's an interesting balance. You know, like I always say, like Claire goes into the newsroom every day and something exciting happens. I've gone into newsrooms all my life, and many, many days, nothing exciting happens. That's I think that's just something I work at too. So you want it to be the way she would talk in a newsroom, but you're conveying it in a way that isn't real, because real is not fiction. These are mystery fiction.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So if I were to ask you. The type of diction the person uses, the imagery, the sound of the voice, the pitch or the volume. How do I know when you're writing? I could tell when people are yelling and screaming and crying. And then lately I've been yelling and screaming and crying, and what did I do to get punished to have to read this? No, I get a lot of books that I don't know about. I mean, I just read, it's really good. I'm sorry he's giving up the series. Mike Madden, Firing Point, the Tom Clancy book. Absolutely fantastic. It's too bad that he's giving it up, because I don't know if Don Bentley is going to be able to do it. It's really good. And I read a book by a new author. After I got the book back, somebody stole the book from the book room. I'm serious. And literally took this one, and they didn't even know what it was. It's called City of Hate by Tim S. Miller. He's got it. It's interesting, because I hated the character, but I grew to love him at the end. So how do you create addiction? How do you create the sound of the person's voice? How do you create sarcasm? Because I know when Claire's speaking, I can know she's getting nasty. I know when Earl is speaking, I know he's getting nasty. I know when Jack is getting really raunchy. I can tell he's – how do you do that? Because I don't know how to do that. No, seriously. I have no idea.
I don't know what to say. I don't
– In other words, I don't either. If I was going to listen to the person's voice – what would I hear? Would I hear a voice that's loud and boisterous? Would I hear a voice that's low when they're speaking? How do they change their intonation? How do they change the way they speak so that I know when they're angry, when they're not angry, so that when I'm reading the book and if I hate the book and the author doesn't know what they're doing, I can figure out what the character's trying to tell me?
If I've done the job
right. If the author
right,
doesn't know what they're doing, you're going to have a tough time liking the book and finishing the book.
This is very true.
Yeah.
And if you know your character and you are in that groove, that kind of comes naturally. You know, I don't think a lot about that. I know, okay, he's got a confrontational scene, or he's about to, you know, somebody has said something that pisses him off, and he's got a sharp rejoinder. That just comes, you know, out of the flow. And if I've done my job right, you don't have to be told he's about to get angry.
I think that's why when you finish the question, Fran, we all were kind of quiet, because
I'm sorry.
that's just part of the craft that you have to that you have to know before you do.
That's the reading person in me. I ask these questions and I
As authors, it's not your job to figure out if he's angry. It's our job to communicate if he's angry. And if we don't do that, then you should put the book down.
But if it doesn't ring true, hopefully you finish it. You should put the book down.
Yes.
Which explains a lot of the books I've been putting down inside and having a trouble reading. You know, I read everything. But if I really feel the book is way out of line, I just write a summary and I won't review it, because I'm not going to pan somebody's work because somebody else might like it. And that's just me.
Right.
And I just won't post it on Amazon. Like I was telling Dick last time, a publisher asked me to read a book. It was a self-help book. And I said to the publicist, I don't want to review this book because I disagree with everything the person said, which is rare. I said, yeah, seriously. And I said, I understand where he's coming from. I understand how he's creating this world. But people that live in the city or don't live in the country can't do that. And how do you invite 100 people to your house for dinner and you don't know them in this pandemic? So I won't tell you the name of the book, and I did review it, and I didn't write anything there. I just wrote what I thought, and then the author sent me an email, could you not post it? I go, well, I haven't done that yet, but I'm thinking, yeah, it was so, it took me like 5 days to read this book. It was very well written, and I'm saying, if you live in the boondocks and you can grow your food at home, that's fine, but if you can't, I mean, oh, well, what can I say? I tried, but, yeah.
One of the things as an author that we have to learn is once the book is out, it's for the reader. It's not for us. So reviews like you post, Fran, are for readers to decide if they want to buy the book. They are not to stroke the ego of the author. They're just not.
The toughest thing for an author to do is take a look at that and, you know, and swallow the ego and find out whether there's a nugget in there for you to get better as a writer. But, you know, your point is dead on. That review is for the reader, and you hope for a good one, but if you don't get a good one, you know, it's like they paid their money, they get to say what they want to say, and you can cuss and kick a can about it, but that's beyond your control.
If you pay the money for my book and you buy my book, you can burn my book. I don't care, but because I got the money for it.
No, I've been sending books to my uncle in California.
Yeah.
He's 99, and he's been reading all of your books, and he's blessing me. He says I'm the best. He's 99 years old, and he's got a girlfriend, people.
Aww.
And, yeah, he's hot, Uncle Len, and he loves me, and he thinks I'm the only he's the only person in my family that reads. So I sent him just about a copy of everybody's book.
Right.
And he's reading them, and he's, like, blessing me forever. So before we end in about 5 minutes, who's got something new coming out and when? And my schedule is tight, so you better tell me so I know when to put you in. Dick, what's next?
I think we should all plug our current books if we could. And so my book is The Last Scoop, as you know, and it's number 3 in the series on TV journalist Claire Carlson, and it's out now in hardcover and also in ebook. And as you know, Claire, I also write some thrillers under the name Dana Perry, and I have one called A Golden Girl out.
That was so good.
Lord, prolific.
Yeah, yeah. and Rick
and my
is
book
the big
is called
money,
what,
as you would expect. Yeah.
And so my book is called What Death Taught Terrence. It is out in hardcover, paperback, and ebook. It's free right now if you have Kindle Unlimited. So if you have Kindle Unlimited, you can get it. It will be out within the week or two in audio. What Death Taught Terrence.
That is fantastic. And Jim, when's your next one coming out? Where can we find you?
Oh, Lord. Well, you can find me just about anywhere. my last book out is called The Best Lousy Choice, and it is another Ed Earl Birch hard-bitten, hard-boiled crime thriller starring that Dallas PI who is battered but relentless. It's available on well, it recently won two awards, so I'll give that a pat. It won a gold medal with Independent Press Book Awards Best Crime Fiction, and then it won a bronze in the ebook Best Mystery and Thriller category for the Independent Publishers Book Awards. So, and the latter one was a gaudy bronze medal that makes me look like I'm channeling Mr. T. So it's available on Kobo, Amazon, Kindle, and paperback. So if you want to jump on the Ed Earl train, do it now. I'll probably have the fourth book out in early next year.
Well,
and my books, my Jack Bertolino series, if you just go to johnlansing.com, it's all there. The Fourth Gunman is the last one that was published, and I finished the prequel. Not sure when that's coming out, but johnlansing.com.
I can't wait already. I can't wait for you guys to write some more. And, Davin, when's the next one coming out?
Well, my current debut novel is Diver's Paradise through Ocean View Publishing, and it's out available in hardback and ebook, soon to be audio. The next one I'm working on, but unlike these other guys, I'm a pretty slow writer, so I don't know. I don't know when it's going to be honest with you. And I'm not even working right now, Jim, so I don't even have that excuse. So I'm just slow by nature.
Did I miss
anybody?
Yeah,
I'm slowing down too. The day job's a good excuse.
Okay, well, before I forget, I'm going to brave this one. My new book is coming out, I don't know when, probably next week or the week after. The title of the book is called What If? What if you could live in a world that Frank created that's based on the pandemic and kind of strange world? Would you be happy in the world that we live in now? What if? And that's the title of my book. And from what I gather from people who read it, it's like more like reading The Twilight Zone. That's all. That's all I'm going to say about that. And I write in first person. I write. I don't put any dialogue. The character's speaking, and if he has quotation marks, I don't know who put him there. No, seriously. I really don't. So if anybody is brave enough to want to join my panel on Monday, let me know. Jim, let me know. I'm going to come up with talking points. I think this is important because there's a lot of negatives about police brutality. I know that. But there's a lot of positive that they do. And in my neighborhood, they're wonderful, so I can't complain. And so I just want to say from both sides, from both points of views, but I want to thank everybody. This has been fun. And if I'm going to come up with some more panel shows probably in September and October. Everybody have a great day. You guys are amazing. I learned a lot. Everybody have a great day, and bye.
Thank you.
Bye, Fran.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
You
bye-bye, Fran.
Bye, everybody.
Nice talking to you all.